for you again today. If you want to keep them, feel free. If you don't, just turn them back and we'll recycle them at the end of the time. Let's go ahead and start the debate. My name is Jim Lundy, and we're going to be talking this morning about what I call Christian narcissism, your entitlement to self-nurturing. Now, let me talk about what that title means in a minute. Why would we put the words narcissism with Christianity? Typically, those words don't go together, do they? We think about narcissism in terms of meism, being self-centered, grabbing for what's mine, and that's not what we mean. But I wanted to focus the idea for us by using that word because I really do want us to talk about taking good care of ourselves, focus on ourselves. Also, we don't usually use narcissism in a title on healthy presentation because narcissism is a clinical disorder. It's a personality disorder of taking too much time to focus on ourselves. And guess which sex has that predominantly?
Men.
How did you guess? Men. You're familiar with that. That's okay. Women have their own disorder. But we've got to come to another session to hear about that. But men in our culture tend to have this problem of being stuck on themselves. And the reason it's important to look at narcissism from a healthy standpoint or self-love from a healthy standpoint is because until we finish this work of making peace with who we are and embracing ourselves, we don't go on to do the other important developmental work that we need to do as people. And so for those of you who had the opportunity to be in Bob Stiver's ethics discussion yesterday on rigor and responsibility, how many of you were in that? A few. This topic is very compatible with his topic because he was talking about the choices that healthy adults have to make in terms of their Christian value system. What I would suggest is that you can't get to the place of talking about rigor and responsibility until you've done your self-work. And so that's what we're talking about today, is self-work. Now this topic is about adults, but we're going to talk about children. Why is that? Because this is the work that we hope to get done in our first 1 to 6 years of life, even optimally in our first 3 years of life. The reality is that many of us don't get it done during those years because of family problems, other pressures on mom and dad, and things in the family. So we end up with this work being undone. Now, if developmental psychologists are right, you can't go on to the next stage of development before you take care of the one that precedes it. It's just like building a house. If you don't put the foundation down, it's pretty hard to frame and wire the house. Although you can go ahead and frame and wire the house without the foundation, and then you end up with men, as we've noted a minute ago, that may have unfinished business in terms of self-focus, and that keeps coming back and haunting us as adults. And so one of the real common experiences we have in the marriage and family clinic is having marriages come in where people are frustrated, can't make decisions, can't get along, and we try a marriage counseling of negotiation, clarification, and communication therapy, where people speak more clearly, use I messages, begin being respectful, and that works. Couple leaves happy, they come back in 6 months, they're just as mad at each other as when they came in the first time. You can see this in churches as well, when you use problem solve through negotiation. What happens is that the self-work comes back up and gets in the way again. Unfinished work at the level of trust, being confident in who I am, my sense of independence, my ability to make choices on my own. And so, again, we want to think today about a multi-dimensional view of human experience. If there's anything I'd really love to teach you and have you go away with, it's not just our topic today about taking good care of ourselves and making peace with who we are. It's an awareness that human awareness, self-awareness, is made up of thoughts and feelings. Feelings are what we experience first in life, and I would suggest to you that they make up 80% of the power and the force within you. And that your thoughts, what you're aware of at a thinking level, makes up 20%. So when you marry a person, it's the feeling component that brings you to them. When you select the church, it's the feeling component. When you stick with a friend, it's the feeling component. Now, when we get into trouble, what do? We often go back and negotiate at the thought level. The trouble is, no matter how well you do with this negotiation, and you make peace, and everybody gets in the car, and they're going in the same direction, you come back to the fact that you just don't feel good about what's going on, and you create another problem. And you see your kids do that, don't you? You can solve everything in a family, and 2 hours later, the old dispute's back, and you don't understand why. Well, what's going on is often feeling stuck. I would also want you to be aware that human awareness has 4 contributing factors that come in all at the same time and mingle together in our consciousness. It's like a stew. You have your inherited biological self, and that has feeling predispositions in it. You have your psychological self and your personal history. This is what we're focusing on today. You have your environmental cultural self. This is what we talked about last night when we looked at the shift in our culture since World War II. And you have your spiritual self and your values. Any one of these areas can have something going on in it that makes you feel a certain way, and the feeling doesn't automatically tell you where it came from. And again, that's a good thing to be aware of when we're with other people, with ourselves, with children. You can have blood sugar problems from a genetic disorder and feel lousy, and you can be angry at your husband or wife and have the same lousy feeling. It feels just the same. You see? And it takes a good investigator to figure out for you, and you need to be your own investigator, what are the things that contribute to my own awareness? And be aware of this multi-factor model. And of course, early at the beginning of our century, we didn't use a multi-factor model for psychology. We used a one-factor model. And we're always looking for the one thing. Today we look at all of these aspects. Okay. Want to make sure we understand that we're not talking about permissive love today, not just giving kids anything they want, not giving ourselves anything they want. That isn't self-nurturing. We're talking about a much more sophisticated embracing of the person for who they are. And I wanted to start with 2 scripture passages for you. One from John 10, the 14th chapter. And this is Jesus speaking, of course. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep and my sheep know me. Just as the Father knows me and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life, only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down on my own accord. So there we're talking about self-sacrifice. We're talking about rigor and responsibility. But notice what it comes out of. A fully formed self. I do this. This is my choice. Nobody's ripping my life from me. I'm making a conscious decision about what I'm going to do. And then also, the Luke passage, which has the take up your cross and follow me passage. Once when Jesus was praying in private and his disciples were with him, he asked them, who do the crowds say I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, the one of the prophets of long ago who has come back to life. But what about you, he asked, who do you say I am? Peter answered, the Christ of God. Jesus strictly warned them not to tell anyone, and he said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Then he said to them all, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. So we're not talking about a permissive kind of love. Now, I understand that we may be stretching these passages a bit, but I have a personal fantasy about this Luke 9 passage, that it's a wonderful translation of a discussion between parents and their children. That your children come to you and you say to them, Well, your friends say this, and you hear this on the news, but what do you think? And the child can, out of their own self, tell you, well, you're right. This is what my friends think. This is what the neighbors think. This is what I hear on the news. This is what I think. And so for me, with the eyes of a psychologist and someone who is a pastor, I see this confession of Peter coming in the context of a question about selfhood, a question about identity, a question about decision making, a question about being able to be at peace with who he is. Now we know later that during the pressure on Peter, his own sense of self broke down and he didn't stick to this and he then regained it. And we could follow that, but we don't have time today. Well, let's take a minute now and turn to your handout, if you would, and we'll begin to work through that. The way I would like to conduct this, after laying this earlier groundwork for you, is that we have a format of open discussion. I'm going to be leading us through this. This is a handout that I use in our clinic and give to many, many clients. And that's why it's a narrative form, not an outline teaching form. It's something that people take with them and begin to internalize about who they are. And most often, this is a handout that would be given to someone who'd been injured in their life, injured by physical abuse, sexual abuse, divorce, family violence, serious rejection, an alcoholic mother, an alcoholic father, many of the things that are literally epidemic in our culture, if you're familiar with the statistics on the violation of persons as they grow up today. Clearly more than 50% of the women in our culture have been sexually violated through their growing up years. The awareness that men have been violated is coming more and more to the forefront. So this is the way that normally I would use this handout, but I wanted to use it today as a springboard for our discussion of our own internal history. The first place I would start under self-love and selfhood is an awareness that in some churches there's spiritual abuse. I might be interested to stop there a moment and feedback on that. But we experience people coming to us saying that in their churches, they have not been affirmed as people, but they were first, and the main message is to take up your cross, to memorize the local statutes and norms, and to get on with the business of being one of the troops in this church, but their own selfhood, their own needs, their own thoughts and feelings aren't recognized. And so we start here with a little statement that healthy persons, flawed like the rest of us, appear to like themselves, and that's compatible with Christian doctrine. Any comments about that? Have you been aware of churches being involved in what we would call, or I would call, spiritual abuse? Any experience with that?
We just had you call when they come in to your community, a real coming out of
evangelism.
Yeah, an event. We just had a big evangelism thing going on in our community, and it was kind of just an interesting dynamic in that respect. That's a lot of, I think, a lot of guilt production and this type of thing. It was fascinating to see the sponsors of that and welcome lots of churches you wouldn't necessarily expect.
So you felt there may have been an abusive component in the message? Or?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think there was.
I would say, especially in smaller congregations where the responsibilities have to be shared by a fewer number of people, the possibility of whatever you call it, spiritual burnout, mm-hmm. spiritual abuse are multiplied enormously, I think. And I've certainly played this off in my own mind between going to, especially in moving to a new community. Mm-hmm. You know, choose a small church where you can get to know people and your children can be feel at home, or do you choose a large church and a small church knowing for me, you know, I have a doctorate degree in New Testament. Well, I know, you know, any church I'm going to go into, as soon as they find that out, you know. And so, you know, as a large church, you can kind of be part of the woodwork, you know, and that's kind of nice. But I'm in a small church now, and I'm beginning to feel that sense of, you know, hey, do this, do that, do that.
I work with someone, she's a Christian but not of the Lutheran tradition, but it seems that in her tradition she lives by a very rigid set of rules to be this Christian. And she would probably consider me a heathen because I'm just not reading the Bible the right way and very, very, very rigid. They don't have a TV in the house, that the kids aren't even allowed to date without an adult present. On your own, it's going to have to be very different stuff. It's very rigid. But even in the Lutheran tradition, I think that we often talk about preaching grace so much, but a lot of us don't hear that really. We seem to hear works and sin and guilt and that stuff, and we don't really grasp grace a lot of the time. I'm not sure why, whether it wasn't presented the right way or what it is.
Well, that's a good question, and I don't have the answer, but maybe suggest some directions. I think grace is harder to teach than rules. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the psychology information I have for us this week would support that as our culture becomes more affluent, we spend less time with children. And one of the things we do because we spend less time is we construct more packages of rules for them because we don't have time to teach them in old-fashioned apprenticeship ways, because we're just in a hurry. And I think that grace or living skills take a lot longer to teach than rules, and it's more expensive.
Also, it takes longer to show somebody something than it does to set up a rule. I mean, if you're going to try to teach by example for children, you have to be there, and we're not with our children as much.
Well, and I think freedom is hard to handle responsibly.
You bet.
This idea of spiritual abuse is a new idea, and I'm not sure that I'm understanding it exactly, but maybe my daughter is more attracted to, she's 17, mm-hmm. My daughter is more attracted to young life as a Christian activity than she is to any traditional church,
right.
Because young life affirms her, mm-hmm. She has fun, mm-hmm. She feels good, she can relate to other kids readily, especially boys. I don't want to speak too much for her, but where to have fun and to relate to others, especially boys, may be bad in certain settings, namely church settings. And so, is that spiritual abuse?
Well, I think that we could sure explain a case where it would be if a parent said you can't go to young life, but you have to go to our church and our youth group with five kids and memorize our rules. And your desire to be with your friends or with your boyfriends in that group is wrong. And that's done a lot in conservative circles. I'm personally from a fundamentalist background where that's done all the time. That's more normative. A child wanting to go to young life and not come to the church building or the church meeting or to hear the specific pastor would be criticized or rejected, and I think that would be spiritual abuse.
Thanks.
It comes in subtle forms, where the essence of it would be, I think, whenever our thoughts and feelings, as we develop our spiritual value system and our selfhood, are criticized and judged rather than processed and discussed. Because nobody's ever stopped kids from dating by making them go to our youth group, have they? We just live comfortably in our denial, and the kids don't go to young life, they go to some other group then behind their back. Okay, another comment and then we'll move on.
I'm wondering about what you mean by this term too. And in our church messages, it seems to me that we're being taught dependency, particularly for women. Women are being taught to be dependent on the authoritarian figure in the family.
Meaning the man? And I think that's another example of religious abuse. A lady came to my office last week after 20 years of marriage where her husband's had 16 jobs. She's had one job all those years. And, you know how that story went. But she said, I went to my pastor 5 years into our marriage and asked him what I should do. And he said, if I would submit more, my husband would develop a better work ethic. And so she was so crushed by that, she went back home and spent 15 more years trying to do it. And then by the time she came to my office, she had to go to the hospital with a nervous and mental disorder of having burned herself out. And she said it took her several months to get the courage to come in for counseling again, having been told the first time that if you just do your job better and be more submissive and more right, that your husband would change. And that would be another example of what I would see as spiritual abuse from the church.
One other example real quickly. A lot of people my age in the 20s, where I worked in Chicago, couldn't understand why I went to church because they had such negative experiences as children. They went to Catholic schools and churches where the nuns were very strict. And they one gentleman told me that he felt sick every Sunday. He didn't even want to go. And that's a good example, I think.
Okay, so you're understanding what we're talking about and why this is important for a lot of people from church backgrounds, and particularly women, and often children, as you mentioned, because their own right to grow, think, and feel isn't affirmed. And rather, we do a quick job of trying to substitute a set of rules that we'd like them to learn and conform to so that they would grow up to be the kind of people that would make us comfortable. And if you're liking Stephen Glenn's material that we talked about last night, I love one of his phrases, which he says, we all want our kids to be born with judgment and sex and never use either one. Essentially, that's the message of the church to many of us as we grow. You have a mind, and you have sexuality, and you have desires. Please don't use any of them. Just do what we would like you to, and everybody will be comfortable. Well, let's move ahead and look at what I want you to keep now as a personal scorecard and maybe a church scorecard under insecurity and selfhood. There's an atrocious sentence in here, and I'm going to read it to you, but I've outlined it on the board for us so that we can talk about it. What we're talking about today from a developmental standpoint, or Eric Erickson's stages of human development, where the first thing we have to do when we come into the world is learn to trust. And this is primarily an activity between mom and child. We dads get in on it some, but really this is a mom and child issue. And then the child begins to develop and move out and make some choices on its own, learn to fall down. What happens? Do we all run and pick her up, or do we let him or her grow on their own? The ability to then make some initiative decisions and make some mistakes without feeling too guilty. And finally, the ability to feel like, hey, I can do something, I'm industrious, I can handle my world, I'm not full of inferiority. But let's look at it under the scorecard, which is the second sentence here under insecurity and selfhood. I'll read it to you, but then we'll work through it. Fully developed selves only emerge in the world of unconditional love, which affirms personal growth, the right to think and feel for ourselves, and the right to learn the lessons of decision-making guided by both gentle instruction and the opportunity for trial and error learning, supported by the helping hand of a wiser, more experienced person ready to help but not to judge or to rescue us in our own efforts. I hope there's no English teachers. That's bad. But we wanted to get it on one page. Here's what we're talking about in self-nurturing. If I could put it in a point-by-point statement, this is something that I would ask you to do a personal scorecard on now for yourself, then maybe how you parent, and then possibly how you've experienced nurturing from others. Do you have other people who do this for you? The first thing is unconditional love. Unconditional love. Do you have people in your world who don't have an agenda for you, who don't have a performance standard that you're supposed to live up to get love, or something else like that? And we need to realize how we live in a culture that's pervasive with conditional love. It starts at birth. It's reinforced the day you walk into a schoolroom. You're asked to do things like math problems, and you're not just checked to see if you got them right, which is bad enough in some cases. You're timed to see if you can get them done 2 seconds faster than the kid next to you. And that's an amazing thing to realize, that we time ourselves when we start learning at such a young age. Very conditional world. Women, again, know more about this than men, in that the culture standard for women's looks and so on don't change. You notice that, women? The covers of women's magazines all have 20-year-olds on them, or people who look like that. It's okay for men to get a little paunchy and to get gray. Those are things that we really let go on. But women are probably subject to more conditional love. Men experience conditions at work. And we'll talk about that when we talk about men and anger. But we need to start here. Many of your parents weren't free to give you unconditional love, because they had agendas in their mind for how you had to grow and develop. And they began working on that at a very young age. And that wasn't because they were bad people. It was because their parents or their church had agendas for them. Now, I come out of a tradition that used to teach this to parents. Spiritual parents always produce spiritual kids. Always. No possibility. Didn't you come out of that tradition? A few, not too many. Wow. You guys don't need this lecture. Those parents, those Christian parents, entered parenthood with agendas that you wouldn't believe, because those kids had to get through adolescence without any slips, or the hand of judgment went back on the parent as well as the kid. And boy, there's a lot of fear in parenthood. Okay, so that's the first scorecard. Mark yes or no for yourself and whoever else you rate. Personal growth. This unconditional love is for your personal growth. Now again, we say, well, that's pretty obvious. Well, it isn't. Many parents don't do well when kids start to separate. Unless your own identity is pretty fixed and pretty confident, when your child begins to move away and become who they are, we tend to do one of two things. We either go get them and bring them back, because it makes us nervous, or since it makes us nervous, when they go that way, we go the other way. And those are the two most common responses in problem homes when kids start to grow and develop. It makes mom and dad uncomfortable. Because when the child was right here, my sidekick, doing everything and thinking everything I did, I was pretty comfortable. And that's why adolescence is so hard on parents who haven't done their own personal work about being worthy of good love and nurturing themselves, because we relive it through our kids. And it just drives us nuts to watch all that happen, because it happens inside of us. Okay, the next one. That in this process, we're encouraged to think and to feel for ourselves, instead of encouraged to foreclose on the party line of how to think and feel. Now, can you think? Go ahead.
It seems to me there's a risk in doing that of falling away from doctrine. If doctrine is a big central issue.
You bet. And that's exactly why we don't do this. Because we get a kid at 9, 10, and 11, and they start to think for themselves, and they come up with conclusions we don't like evolution is true, and we may be a creationist, or we may want them to believe another certain point of doctrine. And we realize that if they think and feel for themselves, that they may begin to move off of our dead center point to some other points. And it creates what emotion?
Fear.
Tension, yeah. Anxiety. That's the predominant emotion that we experience when our kids and others don't think and feel like we do. Do you ever notice this in your marriage? When you're married?
anything else?
When your marriage doesn't think and feel like you do. And you know, you've got to understand that this is just beautiful stuff for illustrations. I mean, I could tell you how students... We could collect the insurance money. She said, well, I got out and told the guy, well, it matches the other fender now, have a good day. So that's her style, see? So that created a lot of tension and anxiety. We weren't thinking and feeling the same way about it. But you see, it wasn't just at a thought level. It was much deeper than that. And this is why when we have these differences, until we are so nurtured in our own inner self that we are at peace with who we are, we cannot tolerate comfortably conflict. And I would give you a little measure of how you know this is going well for yourself, and that's when you can see conflict as opportunity. Because see, this is just a marvelous point you brought up. If we have a difference of opinion in our home now over something like when you should get your ears pierced, or theological doctrine of inerrancy, or a dating issue, and certainly it's more the dating issue than those things in this time. If this conflict now creates in me as a parent a lot of anxiety, and I don't like conflict, and I want you to hurry up and get back and obey me, then we aren't going to have much chance for this person to grow and develop, are we? So I have to get to the place that conflict is an opportunity to discuss it, to explain my point of view, to hear their point of view, to figure out what types of freedoms we're going to have in our house. So the conflict becomes an opportunity. And that can become an attitude. And I think Holden is a nice example of a place where people come here with the idea that differences of opinion is an opportunity. And that's different than most places in our world. Evangelistic meetings, and I used to do evangelistic meetings, are not something you approach with the idea that conflict is an opportunity. You approach evangelistic meetings with the idea that I want everybody to think and feel and believe like I do in the next hour and 15 minutes. And that's my job.
There's risk in the exploration that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. There's also risk in the stagnation of just having your limits completely defined for you. And taking the risk to be able to change the exploration is where the opportunity is.
That's right. And by the way, you said that earlier, I was sure that you weren't advocating that we not allow this. So you've given us the other point now, that there's a risk either way. If you tell a person what to believe at a young age, you may avoid some risk. They may even get to 18 or 19 with no accidents in life. But the risk then you have set up is that they may have no idea how to conduct their early adult life. And I could give you illustrations the whole next of the hour of people doing that, but let me give you two. When I was in California working, a family brought a 17-year-old daughter to me, sat her down and said, hey, she needs to go to the hospital. And she looked perky and fine. Was together, and I scratched my head and said, why? And I said, well, she went to the shopping mall today and she bought, like 20 posters for her room. I thought that was curious. Well, how'd you do this? Well, it was the first time my parents ever let me go shopping alone, and I had about $50 and I've always wanted posters. Well, she had no trial and error learning. So she just did it all. And these parents were so controlling that they saw this little burst of air, that's a lot of posters, as a mental problem. It wasn't a mental problem at all. It was just a lack of trial and error learning. Another much more serious example is a person that I'm seeing who was raised by a very controlling family, but very successful. All the kids were achievers and just did so well in high school. She went off to college and was married 4 times in 4 years. But she'd never been on a date without her dad checking the boy in before he left, checking with them after they left, and it wasn't just healthy, come on in, pick up my daughter and go out. It was grilling and real checking, So she never had a sense ever in her life that she could make a choice. And she didn't realize that when I college and made choices, bad ones, and then she'd get out of them, but it didn't give her a chance for trial and error learning. It was more the reactive, oh no, And so, literally have that number of early marriages. So there's a risk either way, isn't there? And the task for the parent, for you and I in our own lives as well, is to make wise choices about trial and error learning. And the earlier we do it, the better, as long as they're safe. Because it allows a person to develop that sense of competency and capability and personal choice making so that they don't have to try at all to feel like they're a real person. So this is, yeah, the risk happens when we let them think and feel and when we move into trial and error.
I'm just curious about, because that's a big thing that I worry about. You said, you know, you let them do this as long as they're safe. Mm-hmm. Talking about his father grilling them. Mm-hmm. How do you know that they're safe? I mean, you have to trust that the child is making a good decision about the person that they're going out with? Because is that enough to feel that they're safe that way?
Don't you kind of start out like a parent too?
Somebody else would answer.
Yeah. I'm a lot better with my grandkids than I was with my children. You let them make choices like clothing, you know, when they're little. So what if it doesn't quite match? And you let them maybe choose the shoes they want to buy. Those kinds of trial and error things. And then if they get them home, they don't quite like them, then they have to sort of live with that. You know, by the time they get to be teenagers, hopefully you've gotten to the point where they've got pretty good judgment and they're not going to make the life or death mistakes, you know, that we're probably all concerned about when they first get to car the first time and take it out by themselves and those kind of things.
I'm not concerned about dating in this culture that we've created, because we've created kind of a monstrous situation with what is available now, what children grow up with, being on television and so on, and having this lovely daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just terribly fearful of that, not because of her, but because of inability to know. These young people just don't think like we were raised to think in terms of, I'm sounding real conservative here, but
we're all liberals if we got boys. I've got two girls, I get more conservative. There was a man back there.
You just have to, accept that anything you do, you may make a mistake, but mistakes aren't, there's not too many mistakes that are fatal, and you have to learn and then go from there.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of this stuff, if the foundations have been laid, and you keep communication links open, I think you can minimize the possibility of something really getting far off track.
Right.
But there's life is risk, mm-hmm. and to try to shut down risk is to shut down life and to shut down growth. I don't think the price is worth paying at this point.
We'll go to Nancy then.
So I was going to say is that all of this time I've been very interested in who my children's friends are. That's always been very interesting to me, and I've always been concerned about that. And and now as they're starting to have friends of the opposite sex, I'm very interested in those people too. And my children are used to the idea that I'm very interested, and that I ask a lot of questions, and I want to meet these people, and I want to feel good about them. And we talk about how serious these relationships are, that this is very serious stuff, and that they're entering into an arena that has great potential for happiness and great potential for pain. And we talk about it really seriously. And I met Ron when I was 16 years old. So I know from firsthand experience that my son, who was 15, could be entering into a very serious relationship at any moment.
She's got your eyes. Her eyes on your kid.
When they want to do something that I don't feel comfortable about, I let them know. And there are limits. There are just things that right now, it's just not acceptable. And I say,
but you
I know.
Have to know the child they're going out with or the person
they're
going out
sure.
with.
Yeah, sure. And then
and like, you know, that's part
there has to work out arrangements that you feel comfortable with.
You need to get to know them.
I teach dating violence prevention in college. Mm-hmm. And what we say is the best protection is self-esteem. Mm-hmm. If the child feels good about themselves, that is their best protection. Because then they'll be able to communicate how they feel if they get in a sticky situation, and they'll stand up for what they feel is right.
There's, you know, I think all of your comments are excellent, and they just need to put together into one package. There's no one answer for this think and feel, trial and error. But let me reinforce what was said back here. The more we as parents have errors in our mind that we label as death or catastrophe and the life or death issue, the harder it is for the children. So when kids get their driver's license, I always ask their parents, what are you going to do when they drink the first time when they're driving? Now, I'm not in favor of kids drinking. But the point is, I want the parents to think through, if that happened, what would be our family policy? It wouldn't be to kill the kid. But you see, if we set it up that way...
Seriously, mean, okay?
What happened is the kids drink, and then they drive. And if you say to kids, you know, I don't want you to drink at all, but you may be at a party and the friend you're with may drink, and I want you to know something. If you call me, I won't chew you out. Here's our deal. Here's how we're going to handle that. And that does not become permission giving to kids that were raised this way. That doesn't all of a sudden open a door to them and say, oh, wow, since it's okay. It actually helps close the door because it says, well, this isn't a life or death issue. We have a plan for it. I can handle it, and it actually helps them to say no. Very often, giving this kind of permission is the best way to say no, because you've processed it with the child. Another time.
It's easy to talk about kids with think and feel for themselves and trial and error. I'm a senior citizen, single parent, and it's interesting for me how both my friends and my kids don't want me to feel and think for myself, particularly feeling crummy as hell, and do trial and error with my social life. which is not a promotional campaign, but at the same time, it's really interesting for me to see how others react. I've had, in terms of thinking and feeling for myself, I've had several very close friends try to give me pep talks, which did nothing but, I think your word for it is anger. I have some other descriptions of how I feel. Which was an interesting, so that's a growing thing for me.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think we can understand why our kids don't want us to, because they are really developmentally at a place where they're saying, I need you to have this work finished because I've got to bounce my work off of you. Yep. But as adults, we certainly need to move into a different place with each other, and so much even in our marriages where we need to let our spouses work on this work for themselves.
Well, we only had one daughter, but it was kind of interesting that we would ask her, now, when will you come home? When do you think you'll be home? If you're not, be sure and call us, and she always did. And then when she started saying, now, where are you going, and when will you be home? And we really did, because she worried. And in my own life, I came from a very large family, 13, and we had all kinds of parties and things at our house. We didn't want to go anywhere else. My parents made it a thing that it was always open. We could bring anybody home, no matter who it was. We could bring them home.
And what you're talking about there is the helping hand, and we need to include that here. We're not talking about trial and error without a helping hand. We're not talking about a friend of mine, and this is a true story, a Minnesota farmer, who said to his boys, well, you know, you guys want to shoot the 22 today, but there's no animals in the barn, just go out there. And so the boys, who were, you know, 9, 10, 11, learned to shoot the 22 with no adults around. That's not a helping hand. We're talking about a helping hand that's always there saying this to ourselves and to others. You know, I love you, you have a right to be who you are, you have a right to grow and to be who you are, and to feel. But as you do this, if you want to come back to home base and check it out, I'm here to think it through with you. I'm just not here to give you a prescription on how you have to live. And then very clearly, the helping hand is not judgmental, and it's not rescuing. Because rescuing is the other side of judgment. When parents who get real nervous and rescue, we block off the learning opportunities, and we're really evidencing another kind of judgment where we're trying to avoid any problem that might reflect on us. And so we need to sit on our hands as long as we can, and let people learn and then come back. Because when they come back, from the trial and error learning, thinking and feeling, and they want to talk to us, there's a lot of learning that can go on. If you rescue a person just before their canoe tips over in safe water, we haven't let them learn anything. If you rescue them when their canoe tips over before a rapid, you've saved their life. And it's your job to figure out which is which.
So you just said that there is a place for rescuing, but it takes a lot of maturity or insight or good judgment or something to decide when to rescue.
Absolutely. Well, let's turn our attention to a few of these other ideas before we're done. You can look at your scorecard and think about how you're doing with yourself and your kids, and maybe how your church is doing with you. But let's take a moment and just look at childhood deprivation and pressure and selfhood. I want to share with you some material from Bowlby, who's a child psychiatrist, who talks about our culture. He's comparing our cultures to less developed cultures. He says to be a successful parent means a lot of hard work. Looking after a baby or toddler is a 24-hour day job, 7 days a week, and often a very worrying one at that. And he goes on to talk about how unpalatable these truths are for our culture. Paradoxically, it has taken the world's richest culture to ignore this basic fact. Man and woman power devoted to the production of material goods counts a plus in all our economic indices. Man and woman power devoted to the production of happy, healthy, and self-reliant children in their own homes does not count at all. We have created a topsy-turvy world. And that's his analysis of our culture. Now, it's probably not an analysis of your homes, because the people who come to Holden tend to be interested in home life. But in general, it is a scientific fact that as wealth increases in a culture, attention to children during developmental stages decreases. And also, women, you might be interested to know that the wealthier a culture gets, the less support women are given after childbirth. And in our culture, when we have people come into the home after childbirth, they often care for the baby, not the mother. In underdeveloped countries, there's often help 6 months to a year after the birth of a child, and the help is not with the child, it's with the housework and cooking so that mom can be with the kid. Mom doesn't need help with the baby, she needs help with the rest of the house and the family. And that would be one of his arguments. Now here's something else for those of us who are pastors and men who are letting our wives make up the difference. The second finding was even more interesting. When the patterns shown by each child individually were examined, sit down to this one then, no correlation was found between the pattern shown with one parent and the pattern shown with the other. Thus, one child may have a secure relationship with the mother, but not the father, and so on. So our idea that a mom can make up for the lack of father's attention in the child's life was not born true in his research. And I think that's causing a shift in our culture as well. And I would bet we could get illustrations. We might take a few of how men have adjusted their life and work schedule to be more available in the home. Anybody want to share?
Claudia has a grandson who is the primary caretaker. His wife works full-time, he works part-time, and he takes care of a two-year-old and a grandma baby. And he's really just neat with them. He's just very attentive and knows exactly where they are at all times. He has a lot of some fathers may have tend to, they're around somewhere. Mm-hmm. He's very good.
I can say, you know, when I was young and raising my kids, I raised the children. But today, my four grown children, it's a very equal raising of their children, and I made sure that happened. I just thought that was very important. And one of my son-in-laws is a primary caregiver to his child. And I think it's great.
And there is a shift that way. I think men are much, much more involved, and there's a lot more permission for men to be involved. Okay, the second part of this is that many of us in Western society are intent on remaking our children's selves to fit our own unmet achievement needs. And one of the things that I'm always interested in, and this isn't negative at all, but I'm still very interested in it, is the amount of money that's spent on kids' lessons in upper middle class families. It's not uncommon for me to work with families that spend $300 to $500 a month on lessons. Ballet lessons, music lessons, sports camps, and all of those things. And very often, I think what's happening is that there's a lot of pressure on children because of the unmet achievement needs of parents who want their kids to achieve. Okay, then let's turn down to the thinking and feeling self, which is your last section here. And we need to look at a sad truth, but one that we shouldn't avoid today. And that is that adults deprived of unconditional love tend to repeat that pattern. If you were raised punitively, if I was raised punitively, believe it or not, no matter how much we promise ourselves we won't do it, we turn around and are punitive with our children. The more you experience conditional love, the more you're going to have a natural reaction to pass that. The more we were raised with judgment, the more we're going to relate to others with judgment. That's one of the saddest facts about abuse. This talk is also a talk about abuse, isn't it? It's really a talk about what's happening if you don't get this. And abused folks, and many of us are abused, have the sad adult experience of pushing people away because we do to others exactly what was done to us. And it's something we need to talk about because we need to break through the denial in ourselves that we do this and to look at it so that we can begin to alter that pattern. And so one of the saddest things that I see as a day-to-day counselor is that the most damaged people are also the most reactive and judgmental and mistrustful and have a tendency to burn people out. And you can think of that. And we need to be very careful when we talk about that because we're talking about the pain of people. But it really is true that we tend to pass this on. And then another solution we have for not receiving unconditional love is we try to create a perfect family. And that's abusive to the people who grow up in it because they can't be perfect. And to try to create a perfect family is only another way to pass on conditional love. And that also happens in abused people. And it happens to a significant rate in the helping professions across the board. Counseling, mental health, and pastors. And some pastors try to create perfect churches as families to heal their own unmet needs from their own family background. And so we need to keep an eye on that, because until we do our own personal work at this level, we won't be free to relate at a thinking level or at a feeling level well to other folks. And we'll keep getting into trouble when conflict comes up, because conflict will feel bad rather than an opportunity. There's some illustrations on the back that my clients have given me over the years. We have a New Testament scholar with us, and I'm going to leave. You know, we all read the Bible, and we use our discipline to let it speak for us. And so these are psychologisms from the New Testament, and it turns out the book of John, and that's what you're studying in Bible study this week. So any comments would be welcome. But again, going back to the text we started with, I think that the deny yourself and take up your cross is really a discussion in the midst of selfhood. And that the more we develop ourselves, the more able we're going to be to take up our cross. So Christian narcissism is the first job we need to do, Christian selfhood. Then we can do rigor and responsibility. 1 minute of comments, and then we'll let anybody want to give in their last comment.
I would like to ask for the group for opinion, talking about the frenzy of after-school activities that you mentioned a minute ago. I certainly see this in my family. but I see it as kind of a cultural push. Maybe I'm fooling myself, but hey, I'm begging my kids, hey, let's stay home a little bit. Let's stop this crazy taxi service. Let's have maybe two meals a week with each other. And I see this, a lot of this, actually it has nothing to do with what I grew up with, but that doesn't mean that that was right necessarily, but it just seems like all the kids who come from families who can afford it do this kind of stuff. And I'm not sure it's all healthy, but I can't hardly keep my kids running business.
And so you'd like the vote to be, are people resisting it as well?
I'm just wondering if other people are having this experience or not.
You're experiencing lots of after-school pressure, taxi service. We sure are. Well, thank you very much.